Hello everybody, welcome to the Sports Pro podcast. My name is David Cushnan, the Editor-in-Chief of Sports Pro. With me as ever here at Sports Pro Global Headquarters to the east of London is magazine editor James Emmett. Hello James.
Good afternoon David.
And making his Sports Pro podcast debut is features editor Owen Connolly, although he is available on other podcasts. Owen, hello.
Hello David. Thank you for having it. It's a very proud moment for me.
Thank you. That's nice. We are here to review some of the key stories that shaped 2013 and start to look ahead to next year, a year, of course, that includes the World Cup, the Sochi Olympic Games, the Commonwealth Games, and a lot more besides. 12 months to look back on, but James, I guess where we should start is something that happened just a few days ago as we record this in mid-December. IMG, after a truncated sales process, finally sold.
Yes, not 48 hours ago the confirmation came through, David. William Morris Endeavour, big entertainment agency out of Beverly Hills. They've teamed up with their part owner, Silver Lake private equity company, and $2.3 billion is the figure being bandied around, which is a little bit less than Forsman Little, the previous owner, were looking for.
And all sorts of speculation, inevitably, because it is IMG, about what this means for the company, where it's going. We don't know many details yet of exactly what will happen, but what's your best guess? I mean, this seems to be on the surface a predominantly talent representation firm taking over a firm that used to be all about talent representation, but is a lot more besides now.
Well, the list of sort of potential suitors, there were sort of 11 bids initially, something like that, 10 or 11. Got whittled down. CVC, the Formula One owners, were supposed to be the leading bid only last week. The early indication is that it won't be taken apart. IMG won't be taken apart and sort of asset stripped, as a lot of sort of financial bods thought it would be, all these private equity firms involved. They have apparently indicated that they will keep it as a whole, keep it with all its disparate businesses together, at least initially. And then after that, we'll see. I mean, there was a lot of talk. There are businesses within IMG that could easily be broken off. IMG has a big modelling agency, which would probably, although no one really knows what they use the modelling agency for. Some talk that they use it just to supply models for their parties, particularly the tennis party that they have every
year. Is that your speculation?
That's maybe my speculation. A couple of seniors
say supply models for their athletes there for a sec, which would have been
no. That's not their business.
So that's a highly contentious claim.
Not the business that they do regularly.
So it's a we shall see as far.
It is very much a we shall. It's a wait and see thing. 3,500 employees IMG have across the world. They will, of course, be a bit nervous, I suppose, at this point. But for them as well, it's wait and see. And I think the first thing to look for is what happens to Mike Dolan, who is the guy in charge of IMG, the chairman of IMG, a man who has been responsible for really getting the company into ship-shape financially. Sort of optimizing their tax operations around the world, things like that. And he was really brought on by Forsman to do that for the company, to prepare it for sale. So we'll see. I'm sure we'll get that in the next couple of months.
It makes sense. There's a lot of working parts in IMG, and it makes sense that they give it a year at least, maybe 18 months before they really start seriously thinking what they would do with it. I mean, it's a very interesting party to have acquired IMG. When you look around Hollywood, CAA obviously are the other big players in talent representation in Hollywood, and they are now not only not only do they have a long-standing interest in athlete representation, but they've also got into rights arbitrage in Europe with UEFA. So there's that competitive element in it for them, but also, I suppose, just the sheer reach of IMG into places like Brazil and India and Turkey.
So after a year of incessant speculation, we might have another year of incessant speculation, and we may well all reconvene here in a year's time and see exactly what has become of IMG as we know it.
Well, we'll reconvene in a month probably, David, and speculate a little bit more.
Oh, excellent.
On a monthly basis.
Owen, pick out another story from 2013 that was of particular interest and caught your eye.
Well, there were several, I think, that we can probably lump together under the Olympic rings banner. One was the fairly well-expected succession of Jacques Rogge by Thomas Bach, in what I think is a kind of indication that the IOC are reasonably satisfied with how things have been going, but also that they appreciate that there are going to have to be decisions made by somebody who has pretty good working knowledge of how they operate. And then the other thing, of course, was Tokyo. Again, reasonably well expected, although quite competitive bidding process at various points during the year. And then the final thing was wrestling, which was not remotely competitive in the end, having been very much so for several years. And I think that is possibly one of the first things that Thomas Bach, sorry, will need to address, is how some of these bidding processes are handled.
We saw three favourites win, really. I've been quite impressed, and it might be a communications job rather than reality, but I've been quite impressed with the way that Thomas Bach, in just the few months since he took office in September, has been on a whirlwind tour and met many world leaders and other significant sports executives. He has taken the IOC executive board away for a three-day retreat, at which they have put together some proposals under the banner Olympic Agenda 2020. And this is everything from increasing the financial support for anti-doping, for anti-corruption bodies, to undertaking an evaluation of Olympic bidding and the costs associated with bidding for and staging the Olympic Games, even to something that he mentioned just in passing, really, in his manifesto during his election campaign, which is the idea of an Olympic TV channel. He's now commissioned a feasibility study to look at that. I think he's certainly brought a new energy, I think, to the top table at the IOC. And again, it's going to be something that will be the subject of much speculation over the next 12 months, because there's an extraordinary meeting of the IOC now scheduled in for December, at which many of these proposals will be fleshed out a little bit more and some decisions made. But there's definitely going to be, I think, some kind of change or evolution in the way that the Olympic host cities are selected. Interestingly, that will happen at the same time as six cities are already in the midst of bidding for the 2022 Winter Olympic Games, and we'll probably see some movement on that front in the next year as well.
Classic case of new job syndrome, I think, for Thomas Bach.
Yeah.
You'll remember, David, when I was hired by you, I worked quite hard as well.
Yeah.
And that fades, I think, after about 12 months.
Yeah, long gone.
And then you revert to being a safe pair of hands.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. I think with the IOC as well, it's going to be a case of anticipating the transition before it happens. Not between Bach and Rogge, but between the model that served them very well for about 25 years and the one that is probably going to need to serve them well, and the programme that's going to need to serve them well going into the kind of middle of this century. London 2012 was obviously a very high watermark for the Olympics, but you don't want that to be the top of the...
No, of course, they have a couple of very challenging games ahead. Obviously, Sochi is now just days away, really, just a few weeks. until things kick off in Russia for the Winter Olympics. And there's real concern being expressed privately by the IOC about the state of Rio's preparations for the 2016 Games. And I think the Rio organising committee, who have clearly fallen behind schedule in a number of areas commercially and in terms of the way that they're building facilities, are going to get a real wake-up call as soon as the World Cup ends in Brazil next year, and then suddenly all the attention, the spotlight will suddenly shine a lot brighter than it has done so far on Rio 2016, and it might shine a light on a pretty unsatisfactory picture, I think.
Well, then, of course, you've got Pyeongchang, the Winter Olympics in 2018, who have, obviously, it is some way off, but they have very much dipped under the radar at this stage, you know, in the process, certainly for the Summer Games, for Rio, commercial deals were being signed, and there's absolutely no sign of that from Pyeongchang at the moment, whether that is a governmental leadership issue, who knows. But in any case, three very challenging games for Thomas Bach to negotiate before he hands over to his fellow safe pair of hands in Tokyo.
Yeah, I think it's probably not surprising in that context that Tokyo was chosen. I think it's interesting in the context of Pyeongchang to look at what FIFA did with their rights for Russia and Qatar with the establishment of this regional package of rights that they've got. As I say, I think they need to anticipate some of these things before they happen.
Well, there's a on the commercial note and the regional sponsorship angle, there is an acceptance, I think, in commercial Olympic circles anyway, that the IOC's much lauded top model, these sort of set of 10 or 11 worldwide sponsors they have, and then the local sponsors that the local organising committees for each games can sign below that, that needs to change, and there is an understanding that 2020 will be the final year of the current setup, and beyond that they will be working to a new model that no doubt they are cooking up as we speak.
Owen, you mentioned FIFA. Is it time to turn our attentions to what's been going on in the last 12 months at World Soccer's global governing
year. Body? Quiet year for football.
So, Qatar can't be avoided. Is the World Cup going to be played when it's very hot, or is the World Cup going to be played when it's simply hot? And I think we kind of know the answer, and I think we also nearly know exactly when we'll have a definitive answer on that. But there's a wider game being played here, I think, between Sepp Blatter, incumbent FIFA president, and Michel Platini, who most people assume will look to step up from his current role as the president of European football's governing body, UEFA, and challenge Blatter for the presidency. Yeah. That's not until 2015, but we've seen some moves in that regard, and Qatar seems to be the battleground.
Yeah, and I think most people have assumed that. I think it's possibly we could see another one of those years, a little bit like the one we saw with the previous presidential election, where the challenger is the favourite because Sepp Blatter is not terribly popular in the media, he's not terribly popular in the wider world of football. But then you realise the extent of that power base that he has in FIFA. And also, I do think that Qatar is going to be a real, real weakness for Michel Platini. And there's a chance that he could even lose the support of, well, not lose altogether, but certainly the UEFA, you would have imagined, would go out to bat for him pretty enthusiastically. But I think he's possibly frustrated a few people with this. But
Platini, of course, supported the
Platini supporting Qatar,
and Blatter did not.
Blatter not.
Qatar is not entirely at fault. In fact, not really at all at fault for the FIFA shenanigans over when exactly during the season, during the year, the World Cup will be played. But I do think that Qatar had a pretty terrible year in PR terms. Obviously, ranging from simple lack of communication internationally of what it's doing to some absolutely abhorrent and very well reported human rights abuses.
Well, it's one of those things that I think a lot of people discussed at the time, which is this idea of using the World Cup as an incentive to countries to change their ways is perhaps putting the cart before the horse a little bit. And you know, there were very well publicised issues in Qatar before. We knew that they obviously have to kind of produce this infrastructure out of nothing. We knew that it was going to be too hot to play there in June and July, and it's, you know, maybe there would have been a case for doing it the other way around, but now obviously we hope that the World Cup will be a spotlight on these issues, and when it comes to building World Cup infrastructure, things like some of the abuses of workers' rights that have been going on, and things like the kafala system of visa sponsorship will be...
It really comes down to your point of view, whether you do believe, as you say, Ern, hosting one of these major events should in some way be a reward, or whether it should be a catalyst. And I think, I think you're probably right. The order has been slightly wrong on that one. But
I mean, it can be a bit of both, but I think the other thing is that Qatar hosting the World Cup came out of nowhere a little bit. And I think if it hadn't been so far ahead... then possibly we would have seen a little bit of this process happening before.
And I think that's part of the problem for Qatar as well, the fact that there are still 10 years, nearly, until this World Cup takes place, which is longer than any host before has had to prepare, but also be under the spotlight and under scrutiny.
Yeah.
And I think this is not a year that they will look back on fondly. And they may be reviewing, at the very least, their communication strategies.
I have a point on the work that FIFA will have to do in order to come up with a decision of exactly when to play this World Cup in Qatar. You know, whether it is... It will have to be in the winter, the Northern Hemisphere winter, either early year, or what are the options? Sort of a February...
Or November, December.
The end of the year. I think it will be interesting. They will have to, in coming up with this decision, do something that they probably haven't been renowned for in the history of FIFA, I think, which is sort of behind-the-scenes diplomacy. There are stakeholders in sport, whichever way this goes... There are stakeholders in sport who are going to be rubbed completely up the wrong way by this. You know, whether that's the Olympic movement, whether that's American television networks, whether that's, you know, FIFA's representative soccer leagues in various countries. So the job that, and whether that falls to Blatter, probably not. A man who in his position should be a diplomat, who hasn't really excelled at that. I'd be interested to see who it is behind the scenes at FIFA who is putting out these fires before they've really started.
Yeah, and I think the other point that really can't be stressed enough is how much this debate is going to put the club game in competition with the international game. And the World Cup is an absolute six-star, superb tournament that everybody dreams about from their childhood. But that doesn't mean that the reality of putting it on is going to protect it from these kind of forces. It is a really, really big issue if clubs start saying things like we'll withdraw players or, you know, any of the kind of nightmare scenarios that could develop the line.
On the other hand, UEFA have been doing quite a lot of work recently to kind of address that balance between club football and international football, and actually their new week of football concept for their... qualifiers for Euro 2016, you know, these things that are kicking in September. The clubs are actually not too displeased with this because in most cases it gives players a little bit more rest.
Mm. UEFA, of course, led by Michel Platini.
Michel Platini from Qatar.
James, would you like to talk a little bit about a very bitter battle at the top of world cycling?
Yes, I can do. Pat McQuaid, the president of the International Cycling Union, the UCI, was ousted this year in September at the UCI Congress in Florence by his replacement, obviously, Brian Cookson, a long-term president of British Cycling. While the vote itself was seemingly quite close, 24 to 18, I think, by memory, the build-up to it was possibly one of the most farcical things we've seen in these type of presidential elections in sport. Cookson enlisted the support of Vero Communications, an agency that we all know quite well from their work behind the scenes in sport. They run bidding campaigns largely. In fact, they were the architects of Qatar's winning World Cup bid, wouldn't you know? They ran Cookson's successful campaign, and the issue was it developed into a slanging match. Both candidates came up with their manifestos, which were actually, you know, markedly similar. Mm. All very positive things, reform, the way anti-doping is carried out in cycling, continued commercialisation, put an emphasis on the women's side of things. But it developed into a slanging match, and it was played out by a press release, which, you know, was heaven for the media, I'm sure, but all very undignified.
You loved it.
I was loving it, yeah. We were all loving it, except for, I'd imagine, those who had a real stake in it. I don't imagine Cookson or McQuaid was loving it.
No.
I'd imagine whoever it was at Vero who had to write press releases every 6 or 7 hours probably wasn't loving it too much either.
What I would say about that, though, for all the bluster, for all the bitter argument by press release, I would still suggest that the UCI presidential battle, presidential debate, was a more healthy state of affairs than what, quite quietly in the end, happened with World Motorsport's governing body, the FIA, just a few weeks ago, where the incumbent, Jean Todt, was re-elected unopposed in the end to a second four-year term. The rules of the election having made it virtually impossible, and in the end impossible, for a challenger to stand. And a challenger did put himself forward, a British man by the name of David Ward, but he found the rules skewed so much against any sort of challenger that he was unable to get the necessary endorsements to be able to even take part in the election. And I think for all...
Sounds like the America's Cup, right?
Well, doesn't it? I mean, we could come on and talk about the America's Cup shortly. But I think for all the UCI went through the mill a bit and was, as an organisation, I think fairly humiliated by what happened. Perhaps it wasn't absolutely the worst thing.
Well, Cookson did realise this, and you know, part of his campaign all the way through, there was some contention over whether McQuaid should be allowed to stand for re-election. His nominations didn't come through the orthodox channels, shall we say. At the Congress in Florence, there was a big kerfuffle where delegates were sort of asked to vote on whether they should vote to actually vote for McQuaid in the end. And Cookson, knowing that to beat a challenger endorses your presidency if you're going to win. He sort of cut it all short and said, you know, let's just forget this nonsense and let's take a vote, which was brave, and he came out the winner.
And I think, as David said, it is a healthier state of affairs than what happened at World Motorsport and indeed at FIFA a couple of years ago. But it's also one of the things that so much of this reportage of cycling over the last, not just 12 months with McQuaid and Cookson, and with, you know, the Vero campaign as well with Cookson, but also the reporting of what happened in the Armstrong era, has revealed how small some of these sports are on the inside, and it's kind of, and how, you know, they're kind of run like amateur clubs, but they have these enormous amounts of money being invested in them from third parties. And I think that Cookson now will have a mandate to go out and say, look, we need to be more professional about this. We need to be run as a more accountable organisation. And he can start doing that and already has started doing that.
Mm-hmm. In terms of professionalisation, I think we saw that with FILA, World Wrestling's governing body, yeah, as well, when they were knocked off the Olympic programme by the IOC back in April, I think, and eventually there was a huge wave of support to get one of the Olympics' mainstay sports back on the programme, but they changed their leadership, they've introduced new rules, and they've generally sorted themselves out, which is something that if there is an Olympic sport that isn't doing that, then I think they've all been given a wake-up call by what happened this year.
Keeping that theme, if we may, but returning to cycling, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with regards to cycling's place in the Olympic movement, because one of the things that Pat McQuaid fell back on in his campaign for re-election was his position within the IOC. He was an IOC member.
Yeah.
There's almost no chance of Cookson replicating that. Pat McQuaid, of course, was Irish. Brian Cookson is British. Britain already has almost a full complement of IOC members.
And Sebastian Coe very much waiting in the wings.
Yeah, exactly. So Cookson is unlikely to be circulating in the type of company that McQuaid was very welcoming. You know, he's a charming man and a well-respected man in Olympic circles, and he fell back on that position in his campaign to say, you know, to his stakeholders, look, the Olympics is all important for cycling. He can strengthen it and perhaps add events. Cookson, it remains to be seen. I mean, is there a potential weakness there?
Yeah, and conversely, with Cookson, one of his great strengths has been this extraordinary surge from British cycling in the last 15 years, not just in terms of Olympic and road cycling success, but also in terms of participation in the UK, in terms of where cycling is culturally in the UK. The British media being what it is, success stories quickly become, or eventually become, what's behind all that success stories, and perhaps British cycling will be in for a rougher ride, if you'll pardon the expression.
Mm. We won't.
that will be interesting to see if there is any kind of backlash is too strong, but if there is any change in the mood in the media towards British cycling.
Let's talk about a couple more leadership changes. One that's happening in February, one that will happen at the start of 2015, but was announced this year. In the United States, Adam Silver is very shortly going to take over from the man he has been number two to for many years, David Stern. That's at the NBA. And Major League Baseball's long-standing commissioner, Bud Selig, finally confirmed his departure date this year. We still don't know who's going to replace him, but these are two commissioners who have been there for a generation or more.
Well, yes, indeed. And both will be momentous transitions. It's worth mentioning with the NBA first, because that will take place first, as you say, in February. David Stern has been there forever. He is,
or more accurately, 1984.
Well,
as commissioner.
Well, yeah, 30 yeah. years. Yes, yeah. Forever. 30 years. We're all young. Yes. We can't see that.
Yeah,
far
that's
ahead.
Forever for me. So.
Yeah. But anyway. So he's stepping down. Adam Silver, who has been joined to his hip, really, for forever. The transition should be smooth. Silver has effectively been running the league recently. The latest kind of lockout scenario that they had, Adam Silver led the negotiations on the league side. He knows the league inside out. He became, you know, this hip joining happened when he became deputy commissioner in 2006, which was in fact the same year that there last was a change in commissionership at one of the major leagues when Roger Goodell took over at the NFL. But although the transition should be smooth, there are a few points. It will be a challenging year. The transition will be smooth, but the year will be challenging. The NBA is commercializing even more quite rapidly. They brought in sponsor logos on courts quite mm-hmm. recently, which is new territory for them. They're bringing in logos on jerseys, quite controversially in America, but they hope not to cannibalize other revenues through that. And of course, they are probably going to be the next major league to do their next domestic broadcast deal, and nothing less than a huge increase if recent deals are to go by would be deemed a success. There's also the point of David Stern. There is something, a great commissioner for the NBA, but there is something of the ego in Commissioner Stern. I think the fact that he set his own retirement date for 30 years to the day that he took over speaks of a man who is thinking about his legacy. He's also not stepping completely away, which of course has been a challenge for other kind of leadership transitions.
Alex Ferguson, yeah, exactly.
He is offering himself in a kind of consultative role to his replacement. I think one of Silver's biggest sort of behind-the-scenes challenges is going to be in taking Stern's advice, but not no longer being sort of ruled by him.
And Bud Selig, of course, whereas with the NBA, I think it was always a given, really, that Adam Silver, because he had been in this deputy role for so long, would take over. There seems to be a much wider group of candidates vying for, or certainly being considered for, the next commissionership of Major League Baseball, and that would be something to watch.
Well, I think Major League Baseball, these are two sports that are obviously in the now three, big three leagues in the US, but they face very, very different futures, potentially. I mean, basketball, you think, is a natural for international expansion. The NBA is still very popular worldwide. It has perhaps more competition for that that cool, for want of a better word, league globally than it did in the 1990s, but it's still extremely popular in lots of countries. It's very easily exportable.
And they're
baseball, less so, and probably increasingly less so now that it's been locked out of the Olympics, now that you have kind of 2020 cricket in certain territories.
Taste of its own medicine without lockout.
Although it will be interesting to see.
And with the doping issue as well. And it could become a more and more parochial sport, but it can still consolidate and become very commercially successful on the back of that.
And Major League Baseball, I think, is trying to internationalise. Obviously, as you suggested, there are it's much more limiting in the way that they can go global. But they're certainly experimenting in Australia with games there.
Yeah,
but
there's no bat and ball stronghold in Australia.
No,
that anyone can think of.
No. Yes, we're not mentioning we're not mentioning the Ashes because. Anything else, James, that jumped out at you from this wonderful year in the sports
industry? What a year. One thing, we talked on the last podcast, Dave, a little bit about the emergence of BT in the UK broadcast market, and we talked about their Champions League deal. That was obviously a big moment, but I think it's worth going a little bit further back to the work of the Premier League in finalising their international TV rights sales. A quite phenomenal haul of, at my estimate, £2.2 billion for the next 3-year package from around the world. That is, of course, far more than any sports entity could hope to get from, aside from the Olympics, I suppose, but the Olympics has no home market, from international rights sales. It's absolutely gargantuan, and a few, they are the megalith of today's sports industry, and a few territories stood out. They finally cracked, like the Beatles before them, they've cracked America with an NBC deal worth apparently worth $255 million, which is a huge improvement on what Fox was paying before.
Critically acclaimed coverage,
blanket coverage. They've brought NBC into the game.
And like the Beatles, they're on network television, so
yeah.
Lots of homes watching it. I think, you talk about an easily exportable product. Obviously, football is played all over the place. The Premier League, because of time zones, sits quite neatly into lots of broadcasters' scheduling. It's breakfast TV and kind of lunchtime TV at the weekend in the States, where that's quite a difficult slot to fill sometimes, and it's evenings in Asia. And
here's a question: Is 2014 the next step for the US interest and appreciation of football, soccer?
Of the round ball,
NBC on board now, great coverage, good time to watch, and seems to be being watched by more people than ever. The MLS, Major League Soccer, we know is expanding, and there's every likelihood that David Beckham will join the party early in the new year in Miami. Orlando also has a team coming in, and Manchester City and the New York Yankees are combining to bring another professional team to New York. And you have the US national team in a World Cup again, and I think we all remember...
It'll be easy to watch
Exactly, and we all remember the success and the popularity when the US last played in the World Cup in 2010. Is the next step?
Well, I mean, this discussion has been going on for years. You know, when is America going to wake up to soccer? It's only a matter of time. It already has woken up to soccer in a big way. I think that Premier League deal is probably the breakthrough moment for soccer in general across the States, because now you've got genuine competition, big money competition between the networks, and the networks are the ones that are going to promote soccer in all its forms. Fox recently did a deal for the Champions League for a similar cycle, so that's a huge property as well. You've got Fox will be promoting that, NBC will be promoting their Premier League rights for all they're worth as well. I mean, if anything, MLS will probably lose out in the short term with these things going on.
Yeah, except the MLS seems to be run slightly differently. It seems to be very much building a culture from the ground up and depending on local sources of interest. I think the other thing with football in the US with football as a wider question,
soccer.
I'm using the umbrella term football. The NFL is obviously spectacularly successful. It's probably the league that the Premier League aspires to be in some ways. But it's also got this challenge of fewer players at high school level, which eventually could feed into the fan base at adult level. And soccer has had growing numbers playing it, and playing it more seriously, and playing it into high school and college than at any point in its history. I'm not the oracle on this particular statistic, but...
Agree to disagree.
But to go back to the Premier League, this is a bit of a left turn, but the Premier League is doing incredibly well at selling broadcast rights and so on. It is incubating problems at home, however, and I think we need to address this. And, you know, its main challenger in Europe now is probably the Bundesliga, which is kind of on the opposite journey, where it's... in terms of governance back home, is incredibly well set up with fan ownership and with commercial departments being run quite shrewdly and all of this kind of stuff. And what it's struggled to do is match the kind of broadcast revenues that the Premier League is able to produce. The Premier League is basically printing its own money, it seems, in some of these markets. But you have extraordinary issues at the moment with club ownership. I think we've seen what's been going on this year at Cardiff City in particular, and also at Hull. You have issues with rising ticket prices, which could yet come and bite the league as well. As big a success story as it is, these are problems that it needs to confront.
Well, you raised the Bundesliga as a kind of opposite and almost equal to the Premier League there, and I think you're right to do so. The Premier League is so far ahead of all of its competition, not necessarily in terms of the quality on the pitch, but in terms of its commercial performance, and that has been the case since its formation in the early 90s. it has had one kind of motto throughout its existence, and that is just mamma, you know. Money and commercial growth, and all of these issues feed into that. You know, the Bundesliga has a great governance setup, as you say, it has fan ownership. Why would the Premier League look at that when they want?
Well, I think that
when money has always been the be all and end all, but there needs to be a complete change in strategic and embedded thought if the Premier League is going to.
I think what you'll probably see, or what you'd hope to see anyway, is the two kind of moving closer together, taking the right things from each other's. From each other's approach. I think the Premier League, obviously, you know, the money in the Premier League has done lots of things. One of the things it's done is made one of the least safe places to go and watch football in Western Europe probably the safest in the last 20 years. I don't think anybody should forget that, whatever issues people have, you know, supporters have with atmosphere and so on. But eventually, if you have a league where clubs are being kind of run like personal fiefdoms and eventually possibly run into the ground. And if you have the fan culture that I think internationally people kind of want to buy into, they want to be a part of what they see on their TV screens in the Premier League. If that starts to dwindle a little bit, then you might just start to see it eat away at the commercial performance. But it's possibly more from a supporter's point of view and from someone with an interest in the game rather than a pure bottom line perspective.
We could talk about football and football soccer all day, I'm sure. But what
we will, David, after this podcast.
Oh yeah, of course. What we really want to talk about is the America's Cup, right?
We really want to talk about that.
Well, this was truly extraordinary, and it's often said of dramatic sporting events that you couldn't write it, but really you couldn't write what happened in San Francisco.
I think you wouldn't write it because it would seem just really tired and hacky.
Yes. A new breed of America's Cup boats, quicker than ever before, bigger than ever before, but more expensive than ever before, and the number of challenging teams to Larry Ellison's Oracle Team USA dwindled to 3 by the time the Challenger Selection Series began in the summer. There was also tragedy, the very sad death in a capsize of Andrew Bart Simpson, a British Olympic sailor, British Olympic medalist, which cast a pall over events that followed. There were the usual technological rows, and despite a terrific investment in the television product, which was genuinely exceptional, albeit very expensive, it did look as though it was all going to be a bit of a damp squib, especially when Emirates Team New Zealand went 8-1 up in the first to nine battle in the America's Cup match itself. Then an extraordinary recovery by Oracle Team USA. Essentially what happened, and UK listeners may have been fed a story that Ben Ainslie won it by being substituted onto the Oracle Team USA. But what actually seems to have happened is Emirates Team New Zealand basically ran out of money, and in the arms race that is the America's Cup, Oracle Team USA were able to keep developing their boat and keep investing in working out why their boat wasn't working. And they only went and defended it. Mm. Now, this has been sort of widely interpreted as the making of the America's Cup, and now the future is bright. There are still some very fundamental problems with the America's Cup model. The first and most obvious is that until the competition has ended, and you know who's won and who therefore will be organising the next competition, it is incredibly difficult to plan anything, let alone anything commercially.
It's like an FIA election, isn't it?
It is. It is, as you suggested earlier.
Oh, link back to each other.
But I do think it was a bit of a breakthrough for sailing in certain markets, and there was a sense for the first time, I think, that, yes, expensively, But sailing can work on television, and Owen, you're looking a little bit sceptical.
No, not at all. I didn't actually watch the America's Cup, so I'm not going to comment too much on the televisual aspect of it. But what I would say is that the kind of existential crisis that it went through is in no small part as a result of what happened at the last but one America's Cup, where, you know, that's kind of the worst case scenario, where somebody just says, you know, I'm just going to make this up as I go along to make it almost impossible for somebody to beat me. And I think beyond that, it had been experiencing a pretty good run from kind of the early 80s. It's a big issue for a lot of sporting competitions at the moment, particularly as they're kind of now in a wider marketplace, particularly for broadcasters. But I think some of them have to have a little bit of confidence in the inherent appeal of their product. So there's something about the America's Cup being the oldest sporting competition. There's something about it having this kind of, you know, challenge aspect to it, where somebody lays down the gauntlet and you say, right, I'll take
it's a soap opera.
And it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? It's a sword that these archaic rules are both a source of its popularity and in some cases undoing, a little bit like test cricket. You know, people love it for its tradition, but clearly it doesn't attract new people in as well as it might.
We'll possibly get onto that later, you know, about how test cricket's addressing it. But boxing as well is another sport that this year has enjoyed some commercial success, but the kind of the nature of it, the nature of matchmaking, the nature of how these things are set up is hugely appealing when it's the biggest thing possible, and kind of a real source of weakness when it's not.
The America's Cup, or the next America's Cup cycle will begin in earnest early next year when Oracle Team USA and the Golden Gate Yacht Club, which is the sanctioning yacht club for the team, work out or reveal the protocol for the next cup, and we can expect arguments and possibly even legal shenanigans to begin shortly.
Well, New Zealand will be back, at least.
New Zealand will be back. There's some talk of a Ben Ainslie-led British campaign, or that will require some significant funding. And yes, it will be very interesting to see where the America's Cup goes next.
And certainly from people we've spoken to in the last 2-3 years, there does seem to be a collegiate spirit towards making the America's Cup a more manageable deal between the competitions, and we'll see how that develops.
Right, we only have a few minutes left. Any other events from 2013, particular stories that leapt out at you, James?
Well, having just completed the February edition of Sports Pro magazine, I would probably like to cite the example of Mr. Andy Murray winning Wimbledon this year as a breakthrough moment, not just in sport, but in the sports industry. And subscribers will no doubt read the full story when the edition comes out. In January, David, it comes out in January.
Would it be fair to say that subscribers are in for a treat?
They're in for a real treat. But yeah, just worth mentioning that Andy Murray, obviously the first British Wimbledon winner in 77 years, a huge achievement and a wonderful sporting moment, and we all enjoyed it very much over here. But now the work begins on what's next for Andy Murray away from the court in terms of assembling his commercial team, and you know, what kind of a modern day endorsement machine is he going to be?
And what's next for men's tennis? The ATP Tour has relied for the last few years on this fantastic golden era of Federer, Djokovic, Nadal and Murray, who is definitely amongst those four now. What do they do next in terms of developing and starting to promote the next wave of young talent? Because there's the possibility 3, 4, 5 years down the line of a little bit of a void there. I mean, new talents emerge.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Men's tennis generally has been pretty enjoyable over the last 5 years, but there has been that element of Grand Slams are kind of, you tune in on Wednesday afternoon and you know two of these guys are going to be playing each other and the other two will be playing each other the next day. or depending on the schedule, maybe not Wednesday afternoon.
For more detail, we can edit that out.
But it's in a strong position. But as I've said about certain other things, it's about anticipating the transition beforehand.
Owen, you're our resident cricket man. We've had two Ashes series,
unusually, I believe,
within about unusual. 4 or 5 months of each other. Fortunately and unfortunately, two very one-sided series. Mm. What has that done? What's the feeling about what that's done to the Ashes brand?
I don't think that the result two one-sided series with two commercially very, very successful series, and I think it's shown that, you know, that's something that's a little bit archaic, but it's obviously a very easy thing to grasp, but that it still holds a fairly broad appeal, particularly in Australia, where it's still available free to air. But the other thing about that is what it's doing with Test cricket, which is, like a lot of cricket, commercially very lopsided. It's very, very successful in England, where Test matches sell out routinely. I think there are cultural reasons for that, which is that we don't get sunshine for very much of the year, and it's a nice opportunity to sit outside all day. But also it's to do with the way that it's been sold by the ECB and by Sky and by Channel 4 before that. It's very successful in Australia. It's successful in India kind of when it wants to be, but it's not a priority, I don't think, for the BCCI. And for other countries, it's a source of prestige, but it can be a very, very hard sell. You have the World Test Championship, which is being proposed for 2017, but at the same time you're seeing kind of that for the big three in world cricket, the games that really matter are against each other. England don't play South Africa again until 2016. They're the best team in the world. India are playing them now, but they're only playing them twice, whereas they're coming to England to play 5 games next year. So it is a big challenge, and it's a big challenge because cricket is in this position where it's got this probably unprecedented opportunity to grow as a genuine global sport through 2020, but then you have a scenario where it's quite difficult to get in the club with things being as they are. You have the BCCI, who are phenomenally dominant commercially because of the size of that domestic market, and who have their reasons for not wanting to surrender too much of that dominance. And you know, you mentioned my other podcasting activities. One of the things that I was talking about at Wisden India the other day
didn't want to mention it. That's
self-promotional plug. Was Ireland's attempts to get into Test cricket and you know, and to navigate the kind of arcane governmental rules that they would need to become a full member, and who it suits and who it doesn't. And it is an interesting question for a sport which is there kind of at a crossroads.
Is there a sense, do you think, that the ICC, the nominal international governing body at least, are just that, nominal?
You know, how well you get on in cricket politically is kind of how well you handle the BCCI, I think. And even within India, certain power brokers within the BCCI, I mean, Enter Navarzan's had a kind of fantastic year where he's come through this extraordinary story in May with his son-in-law being arrested on corruption charges and you know, all the conflicts of interest that this exposed within the Indian game. And he somehow managed to engineer a route out of this. And
he's almost more powerful than ever.
In some ways, he is, because you're wondering where the challenge is going to come from. You know, I think the ICC, it's interesting with the Test Championship, they have an opportunity to now brand Test cricket as something that they can run, that they have previously had no control over, really, beyond issuing rankings points and having a moderating role in tour programmes.
Let's conclude with something to look out for from each of us in 2014. James, you're looking keen to answer this one. What little bit of insight would you be giving our dear listener?
Well, maybe a little bit of insight from the world of sports politics. Obviously, we've seen in recent days Vladimir Putin smoothing the way for perhaps a not quite as protest-filled Sochi Winter Olympics, releasing contentiously imprisoned people.
See, I thought that was just for Christmas.
Perhaps it was just for Christmas. Perhaps they just done
the real.
Perhaps they just done their time. Yeah. But I would actually point to Marius Wiese as one to watch for 2014. Marius Wiese, of course, is the president of the International Judo Federation. We all know that. But what we might not know is that he was fairly recently elected to become the president of Sport Accord, which is not just a convention, but is also essentially a union of international sports federations.
And Olympic federations and non-Olympic federations.
But, yeah, they're all in the mix. It's a very big body of members. And Mr. Wiese has... he took over from Hein Verbruggen. He was running up against Bernard Lapasse, who had the chief of the International Rugby Board, and he had rather more conservative plans than Mr. Wiese, who apparently intends to set up a bank of sport. A lottery of sport, and he also intends to out Olympics the Olympics with a united championship of world championships or something like that. And it seems to me that, and he is apparently serious about these things, particularly the United Championship idea has already been poo-pooed quite dismissively by various senior Olympic officials, not least the most senior, Thomas Bach. If Mr. Wiese continues in what is quite an underestimated seat of power at Sport Accord, he could be setting the non-Olympic sports federations, who obviously want a bit of a boost, on a course against the Olympic sports federations.
And Owen, something that strikes you, World Cup year?
It's World Cup year. I'm obviously very, very excited about that. I think now that the draw and the, you know, we know who the qualifiers are, we know what the draw is going to look like, we know who's playing who and when. That's all very exciting, and it.
Do you have a world chart yet?
I don't. I'm actually gonna hand make one this year. with no, I might try and get Dan Brown's assistance on that. No, I think the thing that I would be looking at in 2014 that we haven't really had time to discuss is the UFC. Mm. They are going slightly more global next year. Going to some of the markets where their main audience so far has kind of been students at 3 o'clock in the morning and other people with the opportunity to stay up at that time, having events in they've had one in Manchester recently, they're going to have one in London, they're going to have some perhaps in Germany and Sweden and in some of these other markets. We keep being told how it's the fastest growing sport in the world or some variation of that claim. We keep being told how internationally it's going to be very accessible, and I think we might be about to find out.
David, what about you? What's your...
I was just going to say, Dan Brown got a name check there.
That's the sports pro designer Dan Brown. That's not the best-selling but critically reviled author of Dan Brown.
That's for your next podcast.
Yeah.
I'm going to be very predictable, but I genuinely think that something to watch in 2014 is going to be the... Going back to the whole idea of soap operas, is the whole soap opera surrounding Formula One. It's been a fairly dismal season in terms of competitive.
Can I just interrupt you, David, and say something quite nice about Formula One? I think that it is.
This will be
that I'm genuinely quite excited to see some of the new venues that are going to be coming in the next couple of years. I think having a Formula One race in Sochi in particular will be quite exciting. But I'll let you carry on bashing it because that's usually my job, and it's nice to have a break.
There are several things here. First, in terms of the on-track action, which has obviously been lacking, particularly this past season, with another world championship for the all-dominant and superb Red Bull Racing and Sebastian Vettel. But there are new rules coming in for 2014, which should genuinely shake up the pack. New engines, turbocharged V6 engines are coming in, highly efficient, which is a nod to the sort of prevailing mood of the world, and also a bit more in line with what car manufacturers are wanting in terms of putting products on the road. But I think as interesting as the rule changes and what that does to the competitive order will be the changes that we will likely see, I think, in 2014 at the very top of the sport. There's been talk for some time of Formula One being floated in Singapore for about the past 18 months. That was a goer and then was postponed in the wake of Facebook's disappointing float. It's been subsequently delayed by continuing court actions, initially in the UK, but also possibly in the United States and Germany, against Bernie Ecclestone, the Formula One management chief executive. Things are definitely going to change. There's talk of some Formula One teams being very much on the edge financially, and there's vague plans for a budget cap to come in, but I think there will be some seismic changes next year in Formula One from top to bottom, really, and we may even have a new world champion at the end of it, who knows.
Can I tell you what else I'm looking forward to in 2014?
Go on.
Sports Pro Live.
Sports Pro Live. I'm glad you mentioned it, Owen, because I meant to mention it. This is our industry
event.
You
mentioned it last time, David.
Sure. I know, but we have to keep the energy keep the energy up. Sportsprolive.com/registration is where you need to go to buy your early bird tickets for Sports Pro Live, which is our one-day event. It's going to be on Thursday, the 13th of March, 2014, at the Emirates Stadium in London.
To be honest, if you've got this far in the podcast, you may as well buy a ticket.
That's true. Industry insight, the future of global sport will be outlined for you there. We have Casey Wasserman, we have Barney Francis, the Managing Director of Sky Sports, we have Sir Keith Mills, plenty more. All the details are on the website, sportsprolive.com. And you can also subscribe to the magazine, of course, at sportspromedia.com. You can sign up for the Daily Deal, which is our weekday e-newsletter. And you can feast your eyes on all the latest industry news and information at sportspromedia.com. Shall we call it a day?
I think we should.
Season's greetings from Sports Pro. Thank you, Owen. Thank you, James.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Goodbye.